Fish came to the surface, swimming in a circle, mouth gaping, then turned on its back, apparently dead, Costin recalled. Soon there were a dozen fish floating belly up. They had been poisoned. A Guarayo boy waded into the water and picked out the fattest ones for eating. The quantity of poison only stunned them and posed no risk to humans when the fish were cooked. Equally remarkable, the fish that the boy had left in the water soon returned to life and swam away unharmed. The same poison was often used for toothaches. The Indians, Fawcett was discovering, were masters of pharmacology, adept at manipulating their environment to suit their needs, and he concluded that the Guarayos were a most intelligent race of people. After his 1910 expedition, Fawcett, suspecting that the Indians of the Amazon held secrets long overlooked by historians and ethnologists, started to seek out various tribes, no matter how fierce their reputation. "There are problems to solve out here, which shout for someone to undertake them," he informed the RGS. "But experience is essential. It is a folly to enter the unexplored parts without it, and in these days, suicide." In 1911, he resigned from the Boundary Commission to pursue inquiries into the burgeoning new field of anthropology. Once, not far from the Heath River, Fawcett was sitting with Costin and the rest of his team, eating, when a band of Indians encircled them with drawn bows. "Without any hesitation," Costin wrote, "Fawcett dropped his belt and machete, to show he was unarmed, and advanced toward them, hands above his head. There was a slight pause in doubt, and then one of Los Barberos, the savages, put down his arrows and walked to meet him. We had made friends with the Acojas." Over time, this became Fawcett's signature approach. Whenever he came upon the savages, Costin said, he would walk slowly towards them with hands stretched in the air. As with his method of traveling in radically small parties, without protection from armed soldiers, his means of establishing relations with tribes, some of which had never before seen a white man, struck many as both heroic and suicidal. "I know from persons who have informed me how he crossed the river in front of a whole tribe of hostile savages and simply by his bravery induced them to cease firing and accompanied them to their village," a Bolivian official reported to the Royal Geographical Society of Fawcett's meeting with the Guarayos. "I must say they are indeed very hostile, because I have been among them myself, and in 1893, General Pando not only lost some of his men, but also lost his nephew and the engineer, Mr. Mueller, who, tired of the journey, decided to cross from one of the rivers up to the Modedi, and up to this day we have not heard anything about them." Fawcett's ability to succeed where so many others failed contributed to a growing myth of his invincibility, which he himself began to believe. How could one explain, he wondered, standing deliberately in front of savages with whom it was vital to make friends, arrows fixing past one's head, between one's legs, even between arm and body, for several minutes, and yet being untouched? Nina also thought that he was indestructible. Once, after he had approached a hostile Indian tribe with his modus operandi, she informed the RGS, "His encounter with the savages and the way he handled them is one of the bravest episodes I have ever heard of, and I am glad he behaved as he did. Personally, I have no fears whatever regarding his safety, for I am so certain that on occasions like that he will do the right thing." Costin wrote that on their five expeditions, Fawcett invariably made friends with the tribes they met. There was, however, one exception. In 1914, Fawcett sought out a group of Maricoshis in Bolivia, of whom the other Indians in the area had told him to be wary. When he made his usual overtures, the Indians reacted violently. As they came in for the kill, Fawcett's men pleaded for permission to use their guns. "We must fire," Costin yelled. Fawcett hesitated. He did not wish to do so, for we had never fired before, Costin recalled. But at last Fawcett relented. Later, Fawcett said that he had ordered his men to fire only at the ground or in the air. But according to Costin, we could see that one Indian at least had been hit in the stomach. If Costin's account is correct, and there is little reason to doubt it, then it was the one time Fawcett violated his own edict, and he was apparently so mortified that he doctored his official reports to the RGS and concealed the truth his entire life. One day, while staying with a tribe of Acohas in the Bolivian region of the Amazon, Fawcett stumbled across further evidence that seemed to contradict the prevailing notion that the jungle was a death trap in which small bands of hunter-gatherers led a miserable existence, abandoning and killing their own to survive. Fawcett had reinforced this image with accounts of his own harrowing journeys, and he was stunned to find that, like the Guarayos, the Acohas had stockpiled mass quantities of food. They often used the Amazonian floodplains, which were more fertile than terra firma, to grow crops, and they had developed elaborate ways of hunting and fishing. Food problems never bothered them, Fawcett said. When hungry, one of them would go off into the forest and call for game, and I joined him on one occasion to see how he did it. I could see no signs of an animal in the bush, but the Indian plainly knew better. He set up ear-piercing cries and signed to me to keep still. In a few minutes, a small deer came timidly through the bush, and the Indian shot it with bow and arrow. I have seen them draw monkeys and birds out of the trees above by means of these peculiar cries. Costin, an award-winning marksman, was equally amazed to watch the Indian succeed where he, with his rifle, failed again and again. And it wasn't just the Indian's ability to generate an abundant food supply, a precursor to any densely populated, sophisticated civilization, that intrigued Fawcett. Though the Acohas seemed to have no defenses against imported European diseases like measles, which is one reason Fawcett suspected their population was still small, they had developed an array of medicinal herbs and unorthodox treatments to protect themselves against the daily assault of the jungle. They were even adept at removing the maggots that had tortured Murray. The Acohas would make a curious whistling noise with their tongues, and at once the grub's head would issue from the blowhole, Fawcett wrote. Then the Indian would give the sore a quick squeeze, and the invader was ejected. He added, "I sucked, whistled, protested, and even played the flute to mine, with absolutely no effect." A Western doctor who was traveling with Fawcett considered such methods witchcraft, but Fawcett regarded them, along with an assortment of herbal cures, as a marvel. With illness and disease so prevalent, it is no wonder that herbal remedies are used, Fawcett said. It seems as though every disorder has its appropriate nature cure. He added, "Of course, the medical profession does not encourage people to make use of them. Yet the cures they effect are often remarkable, and I speak as one who has tried several with complete success." Adopting herbal medicines and native methods of hunting, Fawcett was better able to survive off the land. "In 99 cases out of 100, there is no need to starve," he concluded. But even if the Amazon could, as he supposed, sustain a large civilization, had the Indians ever actually constructed one? There was still no archaeological evidence. There was not even evidence of dense populations in the Amazon. And the notion of a complex civilization contradicted the two main ethnological paradigms that had prevailed for centuries and that originated with the first encounter between Europeans and Native Americans more than 400 years earlier. Though some of the first conquistadores were in awe of the civilizations that Native Americans had developed, many theologians debated whether these dark-skinned, scantily clad peoples were, in fact, human. For how could the descendants of Adam and Eve have wandered so far, and how could the biblical prophets have been ignorant of them? In the mid-16th century, Juan Ginés de Sepúlveda, one of the Holy Roman Emperor's chaplains, argued that the Indians were half-men, who should be treated as natural slaves. "The Spanish have a perfect right to rule these barbarians of the New World," Sepúlveda declared, adding, "for there exists between the two as great a difference as between apes and men." At the time, the most forceful critic of this genocidal paradigm was Bartolomé de las Casas, a Dominican friar who had traveled throughout the Americas. In a famous debate with Sepúlveda and in a series of treatises, Las Casas tried to prove, once and for all, that Indians were equal humans. "Are these not men? Do they not have rational souls?" And to condemn those pretending to be Christians who wiped them from the face of the earth. In the process, however, he contributed to a conception of the Indians that became an equal staple of European ethnology, the noble savage. According to Las Casas, the Indians were the simplest people in the world, without malice or guile, never quarrelsome or belligerent or boisterous, who are neither ambitious nor greedy, and are totally uninterested in worldly power. Although in Fawcett's era both conceptions remained prevalent in scholarly and popular literature, they were now filtered through a radical new scientific theory, evolution. Darwin's theory, laid out in On the Origin of Species in 1859, suggested that people and apes shared a common ancestor, and, coupled with recent discoveries of fossils revealing that humans had been on Earth far longer than the Bible stated, helped irrevocably to sever anthropology from theology. Victorians now attempted to make sense of human diversity not in theological terms, but in biological ones. The manual Notes and Queries on Anthropology, which was recommended reading in Fawcett's Exploring School, included chapters titled Anatomy and Physiology, Hair, Color, Odor, Motions, Physiognomy, Pathology, Abnormalities, Reproduction, Physical Powers, Senses, and Heredity. Among the questions that Fawcett and other explorers were told to answer were, is there any notable peculiarity of odor attached to the persons of the tribe or people described? What is the habitual posture in sleep? Is the body well balanced and walking? Is the body erect and the legs straightened? Or do they stand and move with the knee slightly bent? Do they swing the arm in walking? Do they climb trees well? Is astonishment expressed by the eyes and mouth being opened wide and by the eyebrows being raised? Does shame excite a blush? The Victorians wanted to know, in effect, why some apes had evolved into English gentlemen and why some hadn't. Whereas Sepulveda had argued that Indians were inferior on religious grounds, many Victorians now claimed that they were inferior on biological ones, that they were possibly even a missing link in the evolutionary chain between apes and men. In 1863, the Anthropological Society of London was created to investigate such theories. Richard Burton, one of the society's founders, postulated that Indians, like blacks, with their quasi-gorillahood, belonged to a subspecies. Darwin himself, who never subscribed to the extreme racialism that emerged in his name, described the Fuegians he saw in South America. These poor wretches, stunted in their growth, their hideous faces bedaubed with white paint, their skins filthy and greasy, their hair entangled, their voices discordant, and their gestures violent and without dignity, as if it were hard to believe they were fellow creatures and inhabitants of the same world. Many anthropologists, including Burton, practiced phrenology, the study of the protuberances on human skulls, which were thought to indicate intelligence and character traits. One phrenologist, comparing two Indian craniums with those of Europeans, said that the former were marked by firmness and secretiveness, and that their shape explained the magnanimity displayed by the Indians in their endurance of torture. Francis Galton, in his theory of eugenics, which once counted among its followers John Maynard Keynes and Winston Churchill, argued that human intelligence was inherited and immutable, and that native peoples of the New World were intrinsically children in mind. Even many Victorians who believed in a psychic unity to mankind assumed that Indian societies were in a different stage of evolutionary development. By the early 20th century, the then popular diffusionist school of anthropologists maintained that if a sophisticated ancient civilization ever did exist in South America, its origins were either Western or Near Eastern, in the Lost Tribes of Israel, for example, or in seafaring Phoenicians. There are all sorts of theories among anthropologists regarding the distribution of the human race, Kelty of the Royal Geographical Society noted, adding that diffusionist anthropologists maintain that the Phoenicians navigated the whole of the Pacific Ocean and that many of them penetrated South America. Fawcett was deeply influenced by such ideas. His writings are rife with images of Indians as jolly children and ape-like savages. When he first saw an Indian cry, he expressed befuddlement, sure that physiologically Indians had to be stoic. He struggled to reconcile what he observed with everything he had been taught, and his conclusions were filled with convolutions and contradictions. He believed, for instance, that the jungle contained savages of the most barbarous kind, ape men who live in holes in the ground and come out only at night. Yet he nearly always described the Indians whom he met as being civilized, and often far more so than Europeans. My experience is that few of these savages are naturally bad, unless contact with savages from the outside world has made them so. He vigorously opposed the destruction of indigenous cultures through colonization. In the jungle, the absolutist became a relativist. After he witnessed a tribe cannibalize one of its dead as part of a religious ceremony, the body roasted over a big fire and cut up and divided amongst the various families, Fawcett beseeched Europeans not to deplore the elaborate ritual. He hated to classify unacculturated Indians as savages, then the common terminology, and he noted that the kind, decent Ecohas were plain proof of how unjustified is the general condemnation of all the wild forest people. Along with adopting Indian mores, he learned to speak myriad indigenous languages. He knew the Indians as few white men have ever known them, and he had the gift of tongues, observed the adventure writer and Fawcett associate Thomas Charles Bridges. Few men have ever possessed that gift to such a marked degree. Costin, summing up Fawcett's relationship with the natives of the Amazon, said simply, "He understood them better than anyone." Yet Fawcett could never find his way out of what the historian Dane Kennedy has called the mental maze of race. When Fawcett detected a highly sophisticated tribe, he frequently tried to find racial markers, more whiteness or redness, that might reconcile the notion of an advanced Indian society with his Victorian beliefs and attitudes. "There are three kinds of Indians," he once wrote. "The first are docile and miserable people. The second, dangerous, repulsive cannibals, very rarely seen. The third, a robust and fair people who must have a civilized origin." The notion that the Americas contained a tribe of fair people, or white Indians, had endured since Columbus claimed that he had seen several natives who were as white as we are. Later, conquistadores said that they had found an Aztec room filled with men, women, and children, white at birth in the face, body, hair, and eyelashes. The legend of white Indians had taken hold perhaps most fervently in the Amazon, where the first Spanish explorers to descend the river described female warriors as very white and tall. Many of these legends undoubtedly had their origins in the existence of tribes with markedly lighter skin. One group of uncommonly tall, pale Indians in eastern Bolivia were called the Yurucares, which literally means white men. The Yanomami of the Amazon were also known as white Indians, owing to their lightness, as were the Waiwai of Guyana. In Fawcett's day, the white Indian question, as it was called, gave credence to the diffusionists' theory that Phoenicians or some other Westerners, such as the Atlanteans or the Israelites, had migrated into the jungle thousands of years earlier. Fawcett was initially skeptical of the existence of white Indians, calling the evidence weak. But over time, they seemed to give him a way out of his personal mental maze of race. If the Indians had descended from Western civilization, there could be no doubt that they could build a complex society. Fawcett could never take the final leap of a modern anthropologist and accept that complex civilizations were capable of springing up independently of each other. As a result, while some anthropologists and historians today consider Fawcett enlightened for his era, others, like John Heming, depict him as a Nietzschean explorer who spouted eugenic gibberish. In truth, he was both. As much as Fawcett rebelled against Victorian mores, becoming a Buddhist who lived like an Indian warrior, he could never transcend them. He escaped virtually every kind of pathology in the jungle, but he could not rid himself of the pernicious disease of race. What is consistent in his writings is the growing belief that the Amazon and its people were not what everyone assumed them to be. Something was amiss. He had seen during his autopsies too many tribes that did not resemble the general European ethnology. In 1914, Fawcett was traveling with Costin and Manley in a remote corner of the Brazilian Amazon, far from any major rivers, when the jungle suddenly opened into a huge clearing. In the burst of light, Fawcett could see a series of beautiful dome-shaped houses made of thatch. Some were 70 feet high and 100 feet in diameter. Nearby were plantings of maize, yucca, bananas, and sweet potato. There didn't seem to be anyone in the vicinity, and Fawcett signaled to Costin to look into one of the houses. When Costin reached the entrance, he saw a solitary old woman leaning over a fire, cooking a meal. The scent of yucca and potatoes wafted toward him, and, overcome with hunger, he found himself being pulled inside, despite the danger. Fawcett and Manley smelled the aroma as well, and followed him. The men motioned to their stomachs, and the startled woman handed them bowls of food. "Probably none of us had ever tasted anything so good," Fawcett later recalled. As the explorers were eating, paint-streaked warriors began to appear all around them. They slipped in by various entrances not previously noticed, and through the doorway beside us, we could see the shadows of more men outside, Fawcett wrote. Their nostrils and mouths were pierced with wooden pegs. They carried drawn bows and blowpipes. Fawcett whispered to Costin and Manley, "Don't move." According to Costin, Fawcett slowly untied the handkerchief around his neck and placed it on the ground, as a gift, before a man who appeared to be the chief. The man picked it up and examined it in stern silence. Fawcett told Costin, "You must give them something." "I myself made a blunder," Costin later recalled. "I not only produced a match, but struck it." There was a flutter of panic, and Fawcett quickly delved in his pocket for another gift, a glittering necklace. A member of the tribe, in turn, handed to its visitors gourds full of nuts. "Our friendship was now accepted," Fawcett wrote, and the chief himself sat down on a curved stool and shared the peanuts with us. They had befriended a previously unknown group of Indians that Fawcett classified as the Mashubis. And while staying there, Fawcett discovered something he had never seen before: a large population numbering in the several thousands. Moreover, the village was surrounded by indigenous settlements with thousands more people. Fawcett's discovery of so many previously unknown Indians prompted a president of the American Geographical Society to proclaim, "We do not know of anything so amazing in the history of recent exploration." It dawned on Fawcett that in regions far from the major rivers, where most European travelers and slave raiders went, tribes were healthier and more populous. Physically, they were less decimated by diseases and alcoholism. Culturally, they remained vibrant. "Perhaps this is why the ethnology of the continent had been built on a misconception," Fawcett said. The Mashubis, in particular, showed evidence of a sophisticated culture, he thought. They made exquisite pottery and had names for the planets. "The tribe is also exceedingly musical," Fawcett noted. Describing their songs, he added, "In the utter silence of the forest, when the first light of day had stilled the night-long uproar of insect life, these hymns impressed us greatly with their beauty." It was true, he wrote, that he had encountered some tribes in the jungle that were intractable, hopelessly brutal. But others, like the Mashubis, were brave and intelligent, utterly refuting the conclusions arrived at by ethnologists who have only explored the rivers and know nothing of the less accessible places. What's more, many of these tribes told legends about their ancestors who lived in settlements that were even grander and more beautiful. There were other clues. On rocks throughout the jungle, Fawcett had observed what appeared to be ancient paintings and carvings of human and animal figures. Once, while climbing a desolate mound of earth above the floodplains of the Bolivian Amazon, he noticed something sticking out of the ground. He scooped it into his hand. It was a shard of pottery. He started to scour the soil. Virtually everywhere he scratched, he later informed the RGS, he turned up bits of ancient, brittle pottery. He thought the craftsmanship was as refined as anything from ancient Greece or Rome or China. Yet there were no inhabitants for hundreds of miles. Where had the pottery come from? To whom had it once belonged? Even as the mystery seemed to deepen, some patterns were emerging. Wherever there are alturas, that is, high ground above the plains in the Amazon basin, Fawcett told Kelty, there are artifacts. And that wasn't all. Extending between these alturas were some sort of geometrically aligned paths. They looked, he could almost swear, like roads and causeways. As Fawcett was developing his theory of an ancient Amazonian civilization, he was conscious of growing competition from other explorers who were racing into the interior of South America to survey one of the last uncharted realms. They were an eclectic, fractious, monomaniacal bunch, each with his own pet theory and obsession. There was, for instance, Henry Savage Landor, who had attracted worldwide renown for his travelogues in which he told of nearly being executed in Tibet, of climbing the Himalayas without ropes and clamps, and of crossing the deserts of Persia and Baluchistan by camel, and who was now wandering through parts of the Amazon dressed as if he were heading off to a luncheon in Piccadilly Circus. I did not masquerade about in fancy costumes such as are imagined to be worn by explorers, while his men mutinied and nearly shot him. There was the Brazilian colonel and part Indian orphan, Candido Mariano da Silva Rondon, who had helped to lay telegraph lines across the jungle, lost a toe to piranhas, and started the Indian Protection Service. Its motto, like his, was, "Die if you must, but never kill." There was Theodore Roosevelt, who, after being defeated in the 1912 presidential election, sought refuge in the Amazon and surveyed with Rondon the River of Doubt. By the end of the journey, the former president, who had advocated the strenuous life, was reduced to near death from hunger and fever, and kept repeating the opening lines to Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, Kubla Khan. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. But perhaps the rival Fawcett most feared was Alexander Hamilton Rice, a tall, debonair American doctor who, like Fawcett, had trained under Edward Ayerst Reeves at the Royal Geographical Society. In his late 30s, with a barrel chest and bushy mustache, Rice had graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1904. An interest in tropical diseases led him to the Amazon, where he investigated lethal parasites by dissecting monkeys and jaguars, and where he soon became obsessed with the region's geography and ethnology. In 1907, while Fawcett was conducting his first surveying expedition, Dr. Rice was trekking over the Andes with a then-unknown amateur archaeologist named Hiram Bingham. Later, Dr. Rice descended into the northern basin of the Amazon, searching for the sources of several rivers and studying the native inhabitants. In a letter to a friend, Dr. Rice wrote, "I am going very slowly, studying everything carefully, and coming only to conclusions after long meditation. If I am in doubt about anything, I return to work over it again." After that expedition, Dr. Rice, realizing that he lacked sufficient technical training, enrolled at the School of Astronomy and Surveying at the Royal Geographical Society. Upon graduating in 1910, we look upon him in a very special degree as a child of our society, an RGS president later noted. He returned to South America to explore the Amazon basin. Whereas Fawcett was impetuous and daring, Dr. Rice approached his mission with the calm precision of a surgeon. He did not so much want to transcend the brutal conditions as transform them. He assembled teams of as many as 100 men and was fixated on gadgetry, new boats, new boots, new generators, and on bringing the latest methods of modern science into the wild. During one expedition, he paused to perform emergency surgery on a native suffering from anthrax and on an Indian with an abscess near her liver. The RGS noted that the latter procedure was probably the first surgical operation under chloroform carried out in this primeval wilderness. Although Dr. Rice did not push his men the way Fawcett did, on at least one occasion they mutinied, deserting him in the jungle. During that same expedition, Dr. Rice's leg became so infected that he took his surgical blade and plunged it into his flesh to remove part of the tissue, operating on himself while he was still conscious. As Kelty told Fawcett, "He is a medical man and very clever in all his work." Fawcett may have been confident that no one could surpass his abilities as an explorer, but he knew that his chief rival had an advantage that he could never match. Money. Dr. Rice, who was the wealthy grandson of a former mayor of Boston and governor of Massachusetts, had married Eleanor Widener, the widow of a Philadelphia tycoon who had been one of the richest men in America. Her first husband and her son were on the Titanic when it sank. With a fortune worth millions of dollars, Dr. Rice and his wife, who donated the Widener Library at Harvard University in memory of her late son, helped to finance a new lecture hall at the Royal Geographical Society. In the United States, Dr. Rice often showed up at appointments in his chauffeured blue Rolls-Royce, dressed in a full-length fur coat. He was, one newspaper wrote, as much at home in the elegant swirl of Newport society as in the steaming jungles of Brazil. With unlimited money to bankroll his expeditions, he could afford the most advanced equipment and the best-trained men. Fawcett, meanwhile, was constantly begging foundations and capitalists for financial support. "Explorers are not often those happy and irresponsible rovers which fancy paints," he once complained in a letter to the RGS, "but are born without the proverbial silver spoon." Despite the vastness of the Amazon, it seemed unable to accommodate all of these explorers' egos and ambitions. The men tended to eye one another hawkishly, jealously guarding their routes for fear of being beaten to a discovery. They even conducted reconnaissance on each other's activities. "Keep your ears open as to any information about the movements of Landor," the RGS advised Fawcett in a communique in 1911. Fawcett needed no prodding. He maintained the paranoia of a spy. At the same time, the explorers were quick to cast doubt upon and even denigrate a rival's accomplishments. After Roosevelt and Rondon had announced that they had explored for the first time a nearly 1,000-mile-long river, renamed Rio Roosevelt in the president's honor, Landor told reporters it was impossible that such a tributary existed. Branding Roosevelt a charlatan, he accused the former president of plagiarizing events from the narrative of Landor's own journey. "I see he even has had the same sickness as I experienced, and what is more extraordinary, in the very same leg I had trouble with. These things happen very often to big explorers who carefully read the books of some of the humble travelers who preceded them." Roosevelt snapped back that Landor was a pure fake to whom no attention should be paid. It was not the first time Landor had been called a fake. After he ascended a peak in the Himalayas, Douglas Freshfield, one of the most distinguished climbers of his day and a future president of the RGS, said that no mountaineer can accept the marvelous feats of speed and endurance Mr. Landor believes himself to have accomplished, and that his very sensational tale affects the credit, both at home and on the continent, of English travelers, critics, and scientific societies. Dr. Rice, for his part, initially found Roosevelt's account unintelligible. But after Roosevelt furnished him with more details, he apologized. Though Fawcett never doubted Roosevelt's discovery, he dismissed it tartly as a good journey for an elderly man. "I do not wish to deprecate other exploration work in South America," Fawcett told the RGS. "Only to point out the vast difference between river journeys with their freedom from the great food problem and forest journeys on foot, when one has perforce to put up with circumstances and deliberately penetrate Indian sanctuaries." Nor was Fawcett impressed by Landor, whom he considered a humbug from the first. Fawcett told Kelty that he had no desire to be counted in with the savage Landors and Roosevelts of the so-called exploring fraternity. Fawcett had often expressed admiration for Rondon, but eventually he grew suspicious of him too. Fawcett argued that Rondon sacrificed too many lives by traveling in large parties. In 1900, Rondon embarked on an expedition with 81 men and returned with only 30. The rest had either died or been hospitalized or had deserted. Rondon, a proud, deeply patriotic man, did not understand why Fawcett, who told the RGS he preferred in his party's English gentlemen owing to greater powers of endurance and enthusiasm for adventure, always resisted taking Brazilian soldiers on expeditions. A colleague of Rondon's said that the colonel disliked the idea of a foreigner's coming here to do what he said Brazilians could do for themselves. Despite Fawcett's imperviousness to the most brutal conditions in the jungle, he was hypersensitive to the smallest personal criticism. An official from the RGS advised Fawcett, "I think you worry yourself a great deal too much as to what people say about you. I should not trouble myself about it if I were you. Nothing succeeds like success." Still, as Fawcett pieced together his evidence of a lost civilization in the Amazon, he worried that someone like Dr. Rice might be on the same trail. When Fawcett hinted to the RGS the new direction of his anthropological inquiries, Kelty wrote back saying that Dr. Rice was sure to go out again and might be disposed to take up the task which you indicate. In 1911, the cohort of South American explorers, along with the rest of the world, was astounded by the announcement that Hiram Bingham, Dr. Rice's old traveling companion, had, with the aid of a Peruvian guide, uncovered the Incan ruins of Machu Picchu, nearly 8,000 feet above sea level in the Andes. Although Bingham had not discovered an unknown civilization, the Incan Empire and its monumental architectural works were well documented, he had helped to illuminate this ancient world in remarkable fashion. National Geographic, which devoted an entire issue to Bingham's find, noted that Machu Picchu's stone temples and palaces and fountains, most likely a 15th-century retreat for Incan nobility, may prove to be the most important group of ruins discovered in South America. The explorer Hugh Thompson subsequently called it the pinup of 20th-century archaeology. Bingham was catapulted into the stratosphere of fame. He was even elected to the U.S. Senate. The discovery fired Fawcett's imagination. It undoubtedly stung, too. But Fawcett believed that the evidence he had gathered suggested something potentially more momentous. Remnants of a yet unknown civilization in the heart of the Amazon, where for centuries the conquistadores had searched for an ancient kingdom, a place they called El Dorado. Chapter 15. El Dorado. The chronicles were buried in the dusty basements of old churches and libraries, and scattered around the world. Fawcett, exchanging his explorer's uniform for more formal clothing, searched everywhere for these scrolls, which recounted the early conquistadores' journeys into the Amazon. The papers were often neglected and forgotten. Some, Fawcett feared, had been lost altogether, and when he discovered one, he would copy critical passages from it into his notebooks. The process was time-consuming, but slowly he pieced together the legend of El Dorado. "The great lord goes out continually covered in gold dust, as fine as ground salt. He feels that it would be less beautiful to wear any other ornament. It would be crude and common to put on armor plates of hammered or stamped gold, for other rich lords wear those when they wish. But to powder oneself with gold is something exotic, unusual, novel, and more costly, for he washes away at night what he puts on each morning, so that it is discarded and lost, and he does this every day of the year." So, according to the 16th-century chronicler Gonzalo Fernandez de Oviedo, began the story of El Dorado. The name means the gilded man. Indians told the Spaniards about this ruler and his glorious land, and the kingdom became synonymous with the man. Another chronicler reported that the king slathered himself in gold and floated on a lake, gleaming like a ray of the sun, while his subjects made offerings of gold jewelry, fine emeralds, and other pieces of their ornaments. If these reports were not enough to excite the conquistadores' acquisitive hearts, it was believed that the kingdom contained vast swaths of cinnamon trees, a spice that was then nearly as precious as gold. As fanciful as these stories seemed, there was precedent for finding magnificent cities in the New World. In 1519, Hernán Cortés marched across a causeway and into the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, which floated amid a lake and shimmered with pyramids, palaces, and ornaments. Some of our soldiers even asked whether the things we saw were not a dream, the chronicler Bernal Diaz del Castillo wrote. 14 years later, Francisco Pizarro conquered Cusco, the capital of the Incas, whose empire once encompassed nearly 2 million square kilometers and included more than 10 million people. Echoing Diaz, Gaspar de Espinosa, the governor of Panama, said that the Incan civilization's riches were like something from a dream. In February of 1541, the first expedition in search of El Dorado was launched by Gonzalo Pizarro, Francisco's younger half-brother and the governor of Quito. He wrote to the King of Spain saying, "Because of many reports which I received in Quito and outside that city, from prominent and very aged chiefs, as well as from Spaniards, whose accounts agreed with one another, that the province of La Canela, Cinnamon, and Lake El Dorado were a very populous and very rich land, I decided to go and conquer and explore it. Daring and handsome, greedy and sadistic, a prototypical conquistador, Gonzalo Pizarro was so confident that he would succeed that he sank virtually his entire fortune into assembling a force, which surpassed even the one that had captured the Incan emperor." Marching in the procession were more than 200 soldiers mounted on horses and outfitted like knights, with iron hats, swords, and shields, and 4,000 enslaved Indians clad in animal skins, whom Pizarro had kept shackled until the day of departure. In their wake came wooden carts pulled by llamas and loaded with some 2,000 squealing pigs, followed by nearly 2,000 hunting dogs. To the natives, the scene must have been as amazing as any vision of El Dorado. The expedition headed eastward from Quito over the Andes, where 100 Indians died from the cold, and into the Amazon basin. Hacking through the jungle with swords, sweating in their armor, thirsty, hungry, wet, and miserable, Pizarro and his men came across several cinnamon trees. Oh, the stories were true. Cinnamon of the most perfect kind. But the trees were scattered over territories so vast that it would be fruitless to try to cultivate them. They were another of the Amazon's pitiless cons. Shortly after, Pizarro encountered several Indians in the jungle and demanded to know where the kingdom of El Dorado was. When the Indians looked at him blankly, Pizarro had them strung up and tortured. The butcher Gonzalo Pizarro, not content with burning Indians who had committed no fault, further ordered that other Indians should be thrown to the dogs, who tore them to pieces with their teeth and devoured them, the 16th century historian Pedro de Cieza de León wrote. Meanwhile, the expedition, less than a year after it had set out, was in tatters. The llamas perished from the heat, and before long the pigs, horses, and even most of the dogs were eaten by the famished explorers. Moreover, almost all of the 4,000 Indians whom Pizarro had forced into the jungle died of disease or hunger. By a vast meandering river, Pizarro decided to split the surviving members of the party into two groups. While the majority continued to scour the shore with him, his second in command, Francisco de Orellana, took 57 Spaniards and 2 slaves downriver on a boat they had built in hopes of finding food. The Dominican friar, Gaspar de Carvajal, who was with Orellana, wrote in his diary that some in the party were so weak that they crawled on all fours into the jungle. Many, Carvajal said, were like madmen and did not possess sense. Rather than return to find Pizarro and the rest of the expedition, Orellana and his men decided to continue down the massive river until, as Carvajal put it, they would either die or see what there was along it. Carvajal reported passing villages and coming under attack by thousands of Indians, including female Amazon warriors. During one assault, an arrow struck Carvajal in the eye and went in as far as the hollow region. On August 26, 1542, the men's boat was finally expelled into the Atlantic Ocean, and they became the first Europeans to travel the length of the Amazon. It was both an incredible feat of exploration and a fiasco. When Pizarro discovered that Orellana had abandoned him, an act he considered mutiny, He was forced to turn back and try to retreat with his starving troops over the Andes. By the time he entered Quito in June 1542, only 80 men from his once gallant army survived, and they were stripped almost naked. One person reportedly tried to offer Pizarro clothing, but the conquistador refused to look at him or anyone else, and simply went into his house and secluded himself. Although Orellana went back to Spain, El Dorado still glimmered in his mind. And in 1545, it was his turn to pour all of his money into an expedition. Spanish authorities maintained that his fleet, with a crew of a few hundred people, including his wife, was unseaworthy and denied him permission to sail. But Orellana sneaked out of the harbor anyway. A plague soon swept through the crew, killing nearly 100 people. Then a ship was lost at sea, with 77 additional souls. Upon reaching the mouth of the Amazon and sailing barely 100 leagues, 57 more members of his crew perished from disease and hunger. Indians then attacked his ship, killing 17 others. At last, Orellana collapsed on deck in a fever and muttered an order to retreat. His heart stopped, as if he could no longer bear the disappointment. His wife wrapped him in a Spanish flag and buried him on the banks of the Amazon, watching, in the words of one writer, as the brown waters that had so long possessed his mind now possessed his body. Still, the allure of this terrestrial paradise was too great to resist. In 1617, the Elizabethan poet and explorer Walter Raleigh, convinced that there was not only one gilded man but thousands of them, set out on a ship named the Destiny with his 23-year-old son to locate what he called more rich and beautiful cities, more temples adorned with golden images, more sepulchres filled with treasure than either Cortes found in Mexico or Pizarro in Peru. His son, more desirous of honor than of safety, as Raleigh put it, was promptly killed during a clash with the Spanish along the Orinoco River. In a letter to his wife, Raleigh wrote, "God knows I never knew what sorrow meant till now. My brains are broken." Raleigh returned to England with no evidence of his kingdom and was beheaded by King James in 1618. His skull was embalmed by his wife and occasionally displayed to visitors, a stark reminder that El Dorado was, if nothing else, lethal. Other expeditions that searched for the kingdom descended into cannibalism. A survivor of a party in which 240 men died confessed, "Some, contrary to nature, ate human meat. One Christian was found cooking a quarter of a child together with some greens." On hearing of three explorers who had roasted an Indian woman, Oviedo exclaimed, "Oh, diabolical plan!" But they paid for their sin, for those three men never reappeared. God willed that there should be Indians who later ate them. Financial ruin, destitution, starvation, cannibalism, murder, death. These seem to be the only real manifestations of El Dorado. As a chronicler said of several seekers, they marched like madmen from place to place until, overcome by exhaustion and lack of strength, they could no longer move from one side to the other, and they remained there, wherever this sad siren voice had summoned them, self-important and dead. What could Fawcett learn from such madness? By the early 20th century, most historians and anthropologists had dismissed not just the existence of El Dorado, but even most of what the conquistadores claimed to have witnessed during their journeys. Scholars believed these chronicles were products of fervid imaginations and had been embellished to excuse to monarchs the disastrous nature of the expeditions, hence the mythological woman warriors. Fawcett agreed that El Dorado, with its plethora of gold, was an exaggerated romance, but he was not ready to dismiss the chronicles altogether, or the possibility of an ancient Amazonian civilization. Carvajal, for instance, was a respected priest, and others in the expedition had affirmed his account. Even the Amazon warriors had some basis in reality, Fawcett thought, for he had encountered women chiefs along the Tapajos River. And if some details in the accounts were embellished, it did not mean that all of them were. Indeed, Fawcett viewed the Chronicles as a generally accurate portrait of the Amazon before the European onslaught. And what the conquistadores described, in his opinion, was a revelation. During Fawcett's era, the banks of the Amazon River and its major tributaries contained little more than small, scattered tribes. The conquistadores, however, uniformly reported vast and dense indigenous populations. Carvajal had noted that some places were so thickly populated that it was dangerous to sleep on land. All that night we continued to pass by numerous and very large villages until the day came when we had journeyed more than 20 leagues, for in order to get away from the inhabited country, our companions did nothing but row, and the farther we went, the more thickly populated and the better did we find the land. When Orellana and his men went ashore, they saw many roads and fine highways leading into the interior, some of which were like royal highways and wider. The accounts seemed to describe what Fawcett had seen, only on a grander scale. When the Spaniards invaded one village, Carvajal said, they discovered a great quantity of maize, and there was also found great quantity of oats, from which the Indians make bread and very good wine resembling beer, and this is to be had in great plenty. There was found in this village a dispensing place for this wine, a thing so unusual that our companions were not a little delighted, and there was found a very good quality of cotton goods. Villages overflowed with manioks, yams, beans, and fish, and there were thousands of turtles cultivated in pens for food. The Amazon seemed to sustain large civilizations and highly complex ones. The conquistadores observed cities that glistened in white, with temples, public squares, palisade walls, and exquisite artifacts. In one settlement, Carvajal wrote, there was a villa in which there was a great deal of plates and bowls and candelabra of this porcelain of the best that has ever been seen in the world. He added that these objects were all glazed and embellished with all colors, and so bright that they astonish, and, more than this, the drawings and paintings which they make on them are so accurately worked out that one wonders how, with only natural skill, they manufacture and decorate all these things, making them look just like Roman articles. The failure of Victorian explorers and ethnographers to find any similar settlements reinforced the belief that the conquistadores' accounts were full of lies, as one historian had earlier described Carvajal's report. Yet, why had so many of the chroniclers provided such similar testimony? Recounting a German-led expedition, for instance, a 16th-century historian wrote, both the general and all the rest saw a town of disproportionate size quite close. It was compact and well-ordered, and in the middle was a house that greatly surpassed the rest in size and height. They asked the chief they had as a guide, whose house was that, so remarkable and eminent among the others? He answered that it was the house of the chief, called Kvarika. He had some golden effigies or idols the size of boys, and a woman all made of gold who was their goddess. He and his subjects possessed other riches. But a short distance beyond, there were other chiefs who exceeded that one in the number of subjects and quantity of riches. A soldier on another expedition later recalled that they had seen very large towns of such an extent that they were astounded. Fawcett wondered where all these people had gone. He speculated that the introduction of smallpox and European disease wiped out the indigenes by millions. Still, the Amazon's populations seemed to collapse so swiftly and so completely that he contemplated whether something more dramatic had occurred, even a natural disaster. The Amazon, he'd begun to believe, contained the greatest secrets of the past yet preserved in our world of today. Chapter 16. The Locked Box. I am afraid there is no way for you to see the document. It's locked in a vault. I had arrived in Rio de Janeiro and was speaking on the phone to a university student who had been helping me track down one more manuscript, what Fawcett considered the final piece of evidence supporting his theory of a lost civilization in the Amazon. The manuscript was in Brazil's National Library in Rio, and was so old and in such poor condition that it was kept in a safe. I had filed formal requests and made appeals by email. Nothing worked. Finally, as a last effort, I had flown to Rio to make my case in person. Situated downtown in a beautiful neoclassical building with Corinthian columns and pilasters, the library contains more than 9 million documents, the largest archive in Latin America. I was escorted upstairs into the manuscript division, a chamber lined with books that climbed several stories toward a stained glass ceiling, where a faint light seeped through, revealing, amid the room's grandeur, a hint of disrepair, dilapidated wooden desks and dusty light bulbs. The area was quiet, and I could hear the soles of my shoes clapping against the floor. I had arranged an appointment with the head of the manuscript division, Vera Fayacci, an erudite woman with shoulder-length dark hair and glasses. She greeted me at the security gate, and when I inquired about the document, she said, "It is, without question, the most famous and sought-after item we have in the manuscript division." "How many manuscripts do you have?" I asked, surprised.
"Around 800,000.
She said that scientists and treasure hunters from all over the world have wanted to study this particular document. After it became known that Fawcett had drawn on the manuscript for his theory, she said, his devotees have treated it almost like a religious icon. Apparently, it was the Holy Grail for the Fawcett freaks. I had rehearsed everything I planned to say to persuade her to let me see the original document, including how important it was for me to assess its authenticity and how I promised not to touch it, a speech that began soberly enough, but grew, in my desperation, more abstract and grandiose. Yet before I could start, Fayacci waved me through the security gate. "This must be very important to you to come all this way without knowing you'd be able to see the document," she said. "I've put it on the table for you." And there, only a few feet away, opened like a Torah, was the roughly 16-inch by 16-inch manuscript. Its pages had turned almost a golden brown. Its edges had crumbled. "This paper is not parchment," Fayacci explained. "It was from before wood pulp was added to paper. It's a kind of fabric." Scrawled across the pages, in black ink, was beautiful calligraphy, but many sections had been washed out or eaten through by worms and insects. I looked at the title on the top of the first page. It said, in Portuguese, "Historical account of a large, hidden, and very ancient city, discovered in the year 1753. "Can you make out the next sentence?" I asked Fayacci. She shook her head, but farther down more words became legible, and a librarian who spoke fluent English helped me to slowly translate them. They had been written by a Portuguese bandeirante, or soldier of fortune. His name was no longer decipherable. He described how he and his men, incited by the insatiable greed of gold, had set out into the interior of Brazil in search of treasure. After a long and troublesome peregrination, and almost lost for many years, we discovered a chain of mountains so high that they seemed to reach the ethereal regions, and they served as throne for the wind, or for the stars themselves. Eventually, the bandeirante said, he and his party found a path between the mountains that appeared to have been cut asunder by art rather than by nature. When they reached the top of the path, they looked out and saw a spellbinding vista. Below them were the ruins of an ancient city. At dawn, the men loaded their weapons and crept down. Amid swarms of bats, they discovered stone archways, a statue, roads, and a temple. The ruins well showed the size and grandeur which must have been there, and how populous and opulent it had been in the age when it flourished, the bandeirante wrote. After the expedition returned to civilization, the bandeirante had sent the document with this intelligence to the viceroy, in remembrance of the much that I owe you. He urged His Excellency to dispatch an expedition to find and utilize these riches. It is not known what the viceroy did with the report, or if the Bandeirantes ever tried to reach the city again. Fawcett had uncovered the manuscript when he was scouring for documents in the National Library of Brazil. For more than a century after the manuscript was written, Fawcett said, it had been pigeonholed in bureaucratic archives. It was difficult for an administration steeped in the narrow bigotry of an all-powerful church to give much credence to such a thing as an old civilization, Fawcett wrote. The librarian pointed to the bottom of the manuscript. "Look at that," she said. There were several strange diagrams that resembled hieroglyphics. The Bandeirantes said that he had observed the images carved into some of the ruins. They seemed familiar, and I realized that they were identical to drawings I had noticed in one of Fawcett's diaries. He must have copied them after seeing the document. The library was closing, and Faiachi came to retrieve the ancient scroll. As I watched her carefully transport it back into the vault, I understood why Brian Fawcett, seeing the document years after his father and brother vanished, had proclaimed, "It feels genuine. It must be genuine." Chapter 17. The Whole World is Mad. Fawcett had narrowed down the location. He was sure that he had found proof of archaeological remains, including causeways and pottery, scattered throughout the Amazon. He even believed that there was more than a single ancient city. The one that the Bandeirantes had described was most likely, given the terrain, near the eastern Brazilian state of Bahia. But Fawcett, consulting archival records and interviewing tribesmen, had calculated that a monumental city, along with possibly even remnants of its population, was in the jungle surrounding the Xingu River in the Brazilian Mato Grosso. In keeping with his secretive nature, he gave the city a cryptic and alluring name, one that, in all his writings and interviews, he never explained. He called it simply Z. In September of 1914, after a year-long reconnaissance trip with Manley and Costin, Fawcett was ready to launch an expedition in search of the lost city. Yet when he emerged from the jungle, he was greeted with the news that, more than 2 months earlier, the Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand, who was the unlikely catalyst for Fawcett and Nina's first meeting in Ceylon, had been assassinated. World War I had begun. Fawcett and his two British companions immediately set sail for England. Of course, experienced men like you are very much wanted. There is a great deficiency of trained officers, Kelty told Fawcett in a letter that December. We have had tremendous losses, as you see, at the front, far more in proportion, I should think, than has ever been among officers before. Though Fawcett was 47 years old and a renegade from European life, he felt compelled to volunteer. He informed Kelty that he had his finger on important discoveries in the Amazon, but was obliged by the patriotic desire of all able-bodied men to squash the Teuton. Most of Europe was gripped by a similar zeal. Conan Doyle, who churned out propaganda that portrayed the war as a clash of chivalrous knights, wrote, "Fear not, for our sword will not be broken, nor shall it ever drop from our hands." After a brief visit with his family, Fawcett made his way to the Western Front, where, as he told Kelty, he would soon be in the thick of it. As a major in the Royal Field Artillery, Fawcett was placed in charge of a battery of more than 100 men. Cecil Eric Lewis Lyne, a 22-year-old second lieutenant, recalled when the Amazon explorer arrived in his dark khaki uniform, carrying his revolver. "He was," Lyne wrote in a diary, "one of the most colorful personalities I ever encountered, a man of magnificent physique and great technical ability." As always, Fawcett was an electric and polarizing figure, and his men fell into two camps, the Costins and the Murrays. The Costins gravitated toward him, relishing his daring and élan, while the Murrays despised his ferocity and unforgivingness. An officer among the Murrays said that Fawcett was probably the nastiest man I have ever met in this world, and his dislike of me was only exceeded by my dislike of him. Yet Lyne was a Costin. Fawcett and I, despite the disparity of our ages, became great friends. Along with their men, Fawcett and Lyne dug trenches, sometimes only a few hundred yards from the Germans, in the area around Ploegsteert, a hamlet in western Belgium near the border of France. One day, Fawcett spotted a suspicious-looking figure in the village, wearing a long fur coat, a French steel helmet three sizes too small for his head, and a shepherd's smock. Queer garments, as Fawcett put it. Fawcett overheard the man saying, in a guttural voice, that this area would be ideal for an observation post, even though it struck Fawcett as a bloody awful place. German spies were rumored to be infiltrating British lines dressed as Belgian civilians, and Fawcett, who knew what it meant to be a secret agent,